Hello and welcome to Q&A Quest episode 430. After another Nintendo Direct, I'm your host Mike Apps, aka Wheels, and with me as always,
alive but no longer kicking, David McGrane.
And congratulations to the Seahawks!
Woohoo! There were a lot of fireworks here last night.
I'm sure.
But also, yeah, there's, woo, go Birds, go Seattle.
Should have been the Bills against Seattle. Patriots were awful.
Then you'd have been disappointed by the results.
I would have been happy that they made it there.
True enough. It's an honor just to be here.
Yeah. Like, if Josh Allen plays his entire career and never makes it to a Super Bowl, that's going to be crushing.
Just ain't right.
Yeah. Anyway, we got a partner direct last week.
Yep. I got the list of stuff that showed up in front of me.
Sweet. I was going to say, not a lot necessarily unexpected, but lots of good stuff.
Yeah, a lot of stuff that I will probably end up purchasing. Got a trailer for Orbitals. That looks neat, like as a co-op game, and thankfully you'll be able to like game share it, so it's less onerous to make sure multiple people have a copy. So I'll probably pick that up. They showed a sequel to Paranormasight. I've not played the original, although apparently it's on deep discount now, so maybe I'll fix that. And then another Captain Tsubasa like soccer game. Apparently, like I heard some people stumping that the last one was a lot of fun. So
yeah, I'm probably gonna have to try that out.
Yeah. I had Tokyo Scramble, which was some sort of horror game that mostly looked like you're trying not to get eaten by a dinosaur.
Looked fun.
Yeah. And apparently it's out.
Is it?
Or will be out in like, it'll be out in 2 days.
Oh, okay. That's random.
Yeah. But yeah. There was Valheim, which that's a reasonably popular survival crafting kind of thing. That I know has existed on other things. And has like a fairly like loyal fan base. So
yeah, it looks
as ever.
Looks pretty cool. Minecrafty, not really more combat. Game, but yeah, those games always lose me when you have to build. Because nothing's
really most of the game.
Is nothing's as easy and as simple as like building in Minecraft. Like building in 3D is not fun at all.
It's more complicated. The more complex the actual geography is.
Yeah.
Then the release of the announced but previously not shown Hollow Knight Switch 2 edition. That's about what you'd expect.
Yes, I played some of that and I noticed no difference whatsoever.
Yeah, I think you'd have to be blind to really get much of a difference out of that.
Maybe if I played it on a 4K TV.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Let's see. Somehow Konami's like soccer game continues to exist. eFootball Kickoff. I have no idea whether those are any good at this stage. I'm not the person to ask, but it was there.
It seems to be live service, so I mean, it's at least
even worse. But then again, like EA Football Club is also basically a horrible slot machine. So
yes, and $60.
Yeah,
I guess it's at least is free.
I have no idea. I don't. I did not care. It's not for me.
Yeah, I don't care. Honestly, I would rather play that Tsubasa game.
Yeah, no. Then at least it's not constantly asking you to take your wallet out again.
Yeah.
We got a release date on Adventures of Aliette. That comes out in June. Still a great game, burdened with a name that makes it sound like a shareware game from 1995. Like, that's gonna sit right in the middle of the Appaloosa Epic Mega Games catalog. But yeah, we also got, in terms of just what, a collection of all of this, of a bunch of Bomberman games.
Okay.
Super Bomberman's like 1 through 5, and I think a couple of the Famicom games. A lot of those never came out in English. They're Bomberman games. You know what they are. But it's interesting that they got released here. In Japan, this was followed up with a Goemon collection that has like 9 games that are basically all of the ones up through the Super Nintendo. And of course, since none of those, basically one of those ever got translated, they've not bothered. They put it on Steam and region locked it to Japan. Like, they do not want non-Japanese people getting this Goemon collection for some reason.
Seems rude.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd love to see it. Honestly, as much as the dialogue can be fun, I don't super think it's necessary to play a bunch of Super Nintendo games. But Konami, in their wisdom, decided no. So hopefully one day that shows up, like how that Kunio-kun World Collection, like years later, just showed up out of fucking nowhere. But we'll see. In one of the things that was not at all a surprise, but was impressive to actually see in motion, we saw FF7 Rebirth, and the actual surprise was it's out in 4 months.
Yeah, that's real soon.
Yeah, like they, I'm almost convinced that they held back Remake for a bit just to make sure that it would, that it and Rebirth would come out close to each other. But yeah, it's I saw someone bring up like the full quality version of that trailer that exists before all like the streaming and YouTube compression, and it's a fucking crazy looking port. Like, just Hamaguchi and his team doing incredible work to make this, like, because like Rebirth was not, you know, Rebirth, because Remake looks good, Rebirth also looks good, but it's not a huge like asset fidelity step up. It's a huge like environmental like loading scheme step up. There's just so much more place to go. And I would imagine that the internal, like the way that environments are loaded, probably got reworked pretty heavily. But it seems like it's running really well. Like, I'm impressed.
I can't wait.
Yeah. And definitely an indication that they are quite serious about getting Part 3 out at the same time on all platforms. Then we saw Pragmata, that had been, you know, they'd announced that a while ago. It had been shown at a few like trade shows and such, but now like the demo that's been on PC is on everything. I've played it. It's a really strange game. It's kind of interesting. I'm going to make a comparison that's going to sound really loaded, but kind of makes sense once I finish explaining it. It feels a bit like The World Ends With You. In the sense that it's forcing you, like, in the middle of combat, it's forcing two very different parts of your brain to kind of be situationally aware. Because you have the parts... because like the gimmick is for core combat that you have, that these robots that you're fighting have like
shields up that can be hacked to get rid of them, and like you kind of need to hack them periodically to do meaningful amounts of damage. And to do that damage, you kind of have, like, while you're aiming at them, the little robot girl on your back is playing a pipe dream minigame. And so how well you're doing, like, you can have different things that augment the pipe dream minigame, but how well you're doing at pipe dream determines how, like, finishing those pipe dream puzzles gets you the, like, makes it so that you can do more significant damage. But you're having to do those in real time while things are trying to beat your ass.
Jeez.
And so, like, even though a lot, and this seems very deliberate, a lot of the robot things that you're fighting are relatively slow, and the pipe dream puzzles are relatively easy, at least in this demo, what you get is that it's, you're still, like, having to split your attention in ways that are pretty hard to do, in much the same way that, like, the world ends with you would have your bottom screen where you're playing as Neku and trying to fight things, and then the top screen you have, like, your partner who's has, like, whatever insane mini game your current partner has. But it's really good. It's a lot of fun, and it looks and runs great. Like, you would not have thought that this was never that this port must necessarily have been a very late addition to their intentions. Because Pragmata, for those not who don't remember, was announced with the PS5.
Wow.
A system which is celebrating its 6th anniversary in about 9 months. It was initially announced with the PS5 with an estimated release date of 2022. And then in 2021, it was delayed to 2023. And then in late 2022, it was delayed to when it's done. And then it finally reemerged fairly recently. But yeah, you would not have thought that this port, obviously, you know, there are clearly sacrifices to get it running on Switch 2. But if you just look at it, it's just like, it doesn't look like something that was severely cut down to make it happen. And it looks and plays really, really well. It's a fun game. I fully recommend that demo for anyone who's curious. It's real strange. But the demo kind of makes a good case for what they're attempting. So I'm very excited for that. And that's in, like, April. Like, that's really close. Then for one of the most inexplicable things to, but yeah, keeping score, like, Pragmata is another one that, like, I have to pick up when that comes out. So the most inexplicable thing perhaps on this is Turok Origins.
Yeah. Was that apparently announced this somewhere had been else announced earlier?
Before. Apparently this had been announced in 2024.
Okay.
And just no one had talked about it since. It's now coming out this fall. And I don't know. Like, it's one of those situations where it's like, this feels like a license that someone was like, well, someone probably remembers this, so make something out of it. And that's what ended up happening. But yeah, I have no idea what to expect of this. I have no familiarity with developers. All I'll say is I have no need in my life for a Turok game that does not allow me to collect 100 triangles, and when I do, my character gains an extra life and shouts, "I am Turok."
Is that something that was in the original game?
Yes, yes, that is in basically, that is in Turok 1 and 2.
Interesting.
Like, you collect triangles like a fucking platformer, and then when you gain an extra life, your character shouts, "I am Turok," and it's very silly sounding. That's all I want in my life, or at least that's all I need from Turok in my life. Let's see. We have so here's another one that was like surprising to see reemerge. Kyoto Xanadu.
Yes.
I didn't think I felt like it was gonna take longer for us to see more of that. Just because it already missed its initially intended like 2025. But it's really weird looking. Like it doesn't it looks like it plays quite differently from Tokyo Xanadu, although not completely differently, but different.
Yeah, it's weird because it looks like you get into a battle and it's looks like battles in Tokyo
Or at least
Xanadu,
boss battle something.
but
Like
it's
because
a
like we also
side
saw action
scroller.
segments in the platformer bit.
Yeah.
Those were just like stab a thing. But yeah, so like this seems to be split into three kinds of things. You have the persona bits that are like time-based life slash social sim, walk around a 2D town kind of thing. You have the dungeon bits, which sort of look like a cross between a Metroidvania and the original Xanadu. And then, oh wait, shit. The original Xanadu had those bits too, where you would walk into an area, and suddenly you'd be in a top-down section. So they've kind of just adapted that, except instead of top-down, you walk into certain areas and you have like big 3D battle arena fights.
Yeah.
It's really strange. It's the kind of thing where like different elements of the core gameplay have been divorced from each other in a very deliberate fashion that you don't that has become very out of vogue. You don't see a lot of games that do that anymore because like the assumption is that the players want immersion and that immersion is broken when two distinct elements of the game have different like visual and control expectations. And Kyoto Xanadu seems to be hearkening back to some older design philosophies by including both the 3D combat arenas and the 2D kind of platformery sections. So that will be interesting. I'm very, it's a very unique thing. I'm glad that Falcom is continuing to produce like weird shit.
Yes, and also apparently it's. They don't usually do like worldwide releases, so it was weird to see it announced
I didn't. Could we even
everywhere at
see
the
who was
same
publisher
time.
on this?
I've only seen the name Falcom,
Yeah,
so I don't know.
are they still publishing?
I don't know.
Yeah, so yeah, maybe it'll turn out to be maybe it will turn out to be gung-ho. Maybe this is them experimenting with the idea. Okay, yeah, apparently currently it's just listed as like Nihon Falcom on eShop right now. But yeah, like this is releasing worldwide all at once. So that'll be interesting. I'm
Yeah.
very curious about that. And that's out this summer. Let's see. And then one of the ones that like I think everyone was kind of expecting to happen eventually, Digimon Story Time Stranger for both Switch and Switch 2
I was not
coming out
expecting
in
that on
July. There's actually a lot of
Switch
summer content here.
One.
What's that?
So I was not expecting it on Switch One. That makes me happy.
I kind of was just by dint of the fact that I think Namco Bandai, like Bandai Namco publishes this. They have been like they put a lot of work into getting their games on Switch One, even when it never made sense. So, like, I'm not surprised that they got Digimon Story happening. Especially because, like, Cyber Sleuth plus Hacker's Memory as a collection, like, goes on sale all the time, and I would imagine they've just sort of slowly accreted a lot of money out of that. Like if you're, for anyone who's curious about those games, they go on sale for $5 all the time. So you don't have to risk that much. But yeah. So Digimon Story Time Stranger is coming out in July for Switch and Switch 2. And very strangely has a 60 FPS mode on Switch 2. It did not have that on the other consoles. I have no idea
So
why. I
weird.
assume they will get patched to include it, but it's very strange.
Yeah.
So that's coming. Another one that was kind of a surprise to see, Granblue Fantasy Relink Endless Ragnarok, which is an updated version of Granblue Fantasy Relink, the game that spent like 6 troubled years in development, passing between Platinum Games and Cygames before coming out and being surprisingly pretty good by all accounts.
Yeah. I liked it. It's a good
And
time.
now it's getting. And now it's getting. And one of the things people usually seem to say was that like it's good, but it doesn't have a ton of content. Well, now it's going to have more. They
And
have.
you can just buy the upgrade if you already own it.
Yeah, if you already have it, you can get an upgrade, and it will be cross-play. So like, if I pick it up on Switch 2 and no one else picks up that version, I'll still have people to play with.
Well, I have it on
So.
PS5 already,
I already
so
sold
I'll
my
buy the up.
PS5 version.
Well, but that's fine. We can still
Yeah,
play it,
because it's cross-play between PS5, PC, and Switch 2. There's nothing to worry about.
Yep. Very good.
That should be fun.
Yeah, very nice to see.
That will show up on Shenan's for sure.
And then we had Monster Hunter Stories 3 Twisted Reflection. That one like comes out in like a month, so this is
Yeah.
just advertising.
There's
But
a demo out for that now, which you all should play.
yeah, there's a demo. Like, Wheels has always been a Monster Hunter Stories fan, so like take his opinion
Yeah.
with a grain of salt. But
Well, it's
I
basically
will try
Monster
it.
Hunter. It's Monster Hunter Pokemon. It's fine. Yeah.
They call them monsties now. It's nightmarish.
Yeah.
Yeah, this one has it's less like I don't know how to describe it. Just play it and check out the story. The story's pretty interesting. Like you actually play as an adult character instead of a kid like the first two games.
Apparently, the Switch version of Stories 1 and 2 is also on deep discount now, so.
Yes, you can get both for $20. And I don't mean
Okay.
like you can buy one and the other, you can buy them each individually for
Like, as
$20.
a
I mean,
collection, it's
yes, you get
$20.
both for $20 total, which is it's great. I'm the Switch version of the first game feels kind of wonky, but it's kind of understandable given that was a 3DS game.
Yeah, it was a 3DS game to its bones.
Yeah. But it's still a good game. Definitely
And
recommend this.
then we got some real sicko shit. So some more Arcade Archives 2. That tends to be the label that Hamster Corporation uses for like Arcade Archives games of like 3D and slightly more recent vintage. So we got Rave Racers, which is one of the many like weird altogether arcade only spin-offs of or Rave Racer. I always forget, like there's Ridge Racer, Ridge Racers, Rave Racer, Rage Racer.
Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of these. They all have strange names. But you have Rave Racer, which is one of the arcade only Ridge Racer titles with very strange with strange names that is hard to remember because it never got a home port. Like it, there was on PS1 there was Rage Racer, which is a different game. Like one of those franchises that it's hard to recall how hard Namco hit it, because Jesus, there's so many of them so quickly. Like the original Ridge Racer is 1993. Then there's a Ridge Racer 2 that is barely a sequel in 1994. which is to say, like, it might have added a track. Like there's very little difference between Arcade Ridge Racer and Arcade Ridge Racer 2. Then the aforementioned Rave Racer, which added a few new tracks, and allowed more players to play together at once. Then Ridge Racer Revolution, which is a PS1 version of Ridge Racer. Like, it's an update. Like, it's a sequel to the PS1 version of Ridge Racer. It is hard to keep track of how these are different. I'm sorry, it's very hard. And then in 1996, Rage Racer. By this point, we are like 5 games in a 3-year span.
Jeez.
There were so many Ridge Racers. But yeah, Rave Racer never saw a home port in its original form. I'm sure bits of it were reconstituted into the PS1 games, but you would have to meet someone who was far more sicko on Ridge Racer for me to fully understand the permutations of how these games were released. But yeah, that's being brought to Arcade Archives, Rave Racer, and then...
Oh, there was also an NES game called Rad Racer.
Yeah, and that's unrelated. That was Square.
Okay.
But in addition to Rave Racer, they announced the release a new line of games called Console Archives, and started it off with some of the most baffling choices you could possibly imagine. So this is from Hamster Corporation, the same company that does the Arcade Archives. They usually do very good emulation. It's you know, it's not the most like complicated, like it's not going to have a ton of new features, but the emulation will be very solid. And it's just, here is the game. You can play the game. So we have, to start with, Ninja Gaiden 2, The Dark Sword of Chaos. On Switch, this is less interesting than it might be on other, than it will be when it hits PS5, simply because, like, obviously, I think you can play Ninja Gaiden 2 just on the Switch Online. But, you know, a version that you can purchase and own, and will have different emulation options. Then things got weirder, because they announced Cool Borders. It's the other thing that they're launching with, Cool Borders 1.
Noted Nintendo game, Cool Borders.
Yeah, so one of the things that they have to do with this is that they have to be kind of elusive about what these games originally released for. So, like, Ninja Gaiden 2 just says it's 8-bit, and Cool Borders just says it's 32-bit. Mysterious. Who could say what it came out on, unless you purchase it, in which case you will see a PlayStation 1 controller, but with all of the Sony trademarks brushed off of it. Like, they had to go into the options menu and airbrush out the Sony logos and the PlayStation logos on the little, like, diagram of what the controls are. But they did it. You can play Cool Borders on your Switch 2 for some reason. And then the rest of the lineup is completely insane. There's a Doraemon game that will be coming out in July. A Nobunaga's Ambition game, Magmax, Sonic Wings Special, Desaimon Plus, Rhapsody, a musical adventure, not even the first time that's been released on Switch.
No.
I have my doubts that we will be seeing the original English dub, just because it is a licensing nightmare by all appearances.
Well, then what is even the point? You already have that game on Switch.
I don't know, but it's there. It'll probably be a little cheaper than buying it any other way, but we'll see. Master of Monsters, Disciples of Gaia. Sure. And then the last two just made me, like, when I saw them on the screen, I thought I was having a stroke. Because one of them is Monster Rancher Hopabout, which is a action puzzle game where monsters from Monster Rancher bounce around on pogo sticks. I don't understand how that came back. I don't understand. I didn't think anyone else remembered it existed. But there it is. It will be available on your Switch 2 and PS5. And then the beautiful last thing that is like bittersweet to see, UFO: A Day in the Life, one of the three games that Lovadelic managed to produce before dying, which will be coming out of the console archives, but it doesn't have an extant translation, and they're probably not going to add one.
Aww.
You win some, you lose some. It's nice that it's possible to purchase. let's see. So yeah, console archives sounds deranged. There was like a huge hamster live stream afterwards where they sort of went over this. And I'm given to understand that they like implied the existence of a ton of other games. The most recent of which was listed. They didn't say what it was, but they gave a year for it of 2009. So I'm very curious. like that. I did not have the time nor Japanese to scrub through a 3-hour live stream of Hamster Corporation explaining what the fuck they were doing. But I respect it. Hamster Corporation is the kind of company that I would want to be a part of if I had the communication and technical chops to make it happen. let's see. So we have, and if you're unaware, Hamster has been doing the re-release old arcade games for so long. Like, they released, to my recall, they released a boxed PlayStation 2 release of Trio the Punch, Never Forget Me. I don't...
Okay.
If you don't know about Trio the Punch, I don't know how to describe how absurd it is to sell a like physical PS2 release of a game that was like generally regarded by Japanese arcade goers as like something of a shitpost.
Mm-hmm.
Like perhaps a possibly intentional kusoge from like the 80s that they just emulated, slapped on a disc, and released. Yeah, as a physical object you could own on the PlayStation 2 back in 2007.
Cool.
If you've never seen Trio the Punch, it is available in wherever you want to buy arcade archives, and it is a very strange game. Or you could look it up on YouTube, but it's very strange.
I was going to say real quick, on Switch, I have Metal Slug 5, Prehistoric Isle 2, Shock Trooper Second Squad, and Versus Super Mario Brothers. Those are all Hamster releases. So I think they've done Hamster the entire...
Like early in the Switch's life, Hamster went to the trouble of like getting, striking a deal with Nintendo to release arcade games that Nintendo had just never released. Like, never re-released, never home ported, like Versus Super Mario Brothers, which has some new stages right at the end, and some other weird ones, like I want to say Skyhopper. That sounds right.
And I think they did the arcade version of Punch-Out as well.
Skyskipper, yeah. And yeah, like because they were just doing Nintendo's old arcade games that had never really seen home release.
And they also, it seems like they did the entire Neo Geo catalog as well, I think, or close to it.
Like, as close as they could get. Like, a lot of those games. But yeah, like, Hamster does, like, an even mix of things you've heard of and things no one has thought of since 1988. so, you know, they are dear to my heart. Then we got kind of a montage, Scott Pilgrim X. That looks great. Tribute Games has only gotten better over the years. And I appreciate them going back to the Scott Pilgrim license and doing something that seems to be taking a lot of the Scott Pilgrim Takes Off ideas and kind of remixing those. So, very excited for that. Another Eden Begins, which seems to be a like reconstituting a gacha mobile game into an actual game. Like it's a game that Masato Kato was party to, for those who remember that name. Like Masato Kato was the was like the a lead on both Chrono Trigger and Chrono Cross. He's done a number of things since. But yeah, it's them kind of taking some of the mobile like gacha game that they had made and sort of like, it's like Octopath Traveler Zero in that it's not like a direct port of the mobile thing, but it's like taking a bunch of that content and reconstituting it into an actual game. Then saw the Switch 2 version of Reanimal, the game from the devs of the first two Little Nightmares.
Yes.
I talked about this before, but that was a little weird. They got a whole different team to do Little Nightmares 3, and only several months later, they're already saying, oh, well, here's the original 1 and 2 developers with a different publisher doing a very similar game, and they both have,
I'd imagine those entered development around the same time.
Yeah, or maybe, I don't know, because Little Nightmares 3 got delayed a few times, and I don't know, I wonder if there was just a troubled production and people left or something, who knows. Yeah. Or maybe they were the same game to start with and just split off. I don't know.
I can't imagine the legalities that would allow that to happen. I would suspect that there was simply dev team splits off due to like publisher dispute and produces Reanimal and has to naturally spend time doing things like finding a new publisher.
Yeah. So I did play there is a demo of Reanimal. I played it. It's just like Little Nightmares, but that's fine if you like it. You know.
I mean, Little Nightmares is popular.
Yeah, I mean, the third game was a little disappointing, but Reanimal seems like it's, you know, creepy game. It's fine. I'm sorry, as we're talking, I'm actually playing the Switch 2 demo of Pragmata, and like, this is awesome.
It's a great game, and it's a very impressive technical showcase. But, let's see. Then we did further into the montage, we get WWE 2K26. Not surprising after 2K25, that was a great port. I would suspect this one will be too.
Mm-hmm.
But this one's coming out the same day as every other version, which, you know, been a minute since that happened. So one of the other baffling things that crossed my eyes, how is there a Star Trek Voyager specifically, a Star Trek Voyager game coming out?
I don't know.
When?
This year?
I think it's already out.
Why?
Oh, it might be. Don't know. But it was just called Star Trek Voyager Across the Unknown. I'm baffled. I don't know what would have caused this game to happen. I couldn't quite tell what kind of game it was. Then Disney Dreamlight Valley Switch 2 Edition, which definitely a Switch 2 Edition that I'm not surprised exists, because by all accounts, Disney Dreamlight Valley on Switch 1 was both popular and ran like absolute dog shit. So, you know, the Switch 2 Edition seems like a no-brainer there. Then PGA Tour 2K25.
Golf.
Here's more golf.
Nobody cares.
Someone cares.
Not me. Listen, they can't even get cover athletes for these anymore. But let's see. Then Cold Sept Begins, which I think is like an update of the Cold Sept before the first one we got on PS2. But if you're a depraved sicko that wants a combination of a collectible card game and a board game, Cold Sept has begun.
Just stick it in my veins.
Yeah, this is for the wheelses of the world.
Yes, I want. Give me.
Pump it to my veins.
Then Goat Simulator 3, another thing that hadn't been announced, but isn't at all surprising. Shadow Tactics: Blade of the Shogun. I'm sure I saw this in the direct. I cannot conjure a single thought about what it is. I presume it's an existing property because it ended up in the, like, here's a whole bunch of stuff. But yeah. Then Tales of Arise Beyond the Dawn Edition. That's Switch 2 specific, and it seems to, it looks like it's basically just Tales of Arise, plus it's DLC that is apparently of questionable quality if our Tales of Arise correspondent Tam is to be believed. But, well, you can't get one without the other, so.
But you don't but, have to play it.
Yep, you can always just stop. And then Resident Evil Requiem, I'm not surprised to see that show up because that's a fucking showstopper showpiece of a game. Like that looks absolutely crazy on this hardware. And yeah, you know, that comes out at the end of this month. You were going to hear me talk about that too much, so I'm just going to move on. And then the direct ended with a triple shot from Bethesda of two very not great looking ports and one extremely good looking port that feels like it was wished for upon a monkey's paw. So yeah, Fallout 4 Anniversary Edition. Fallout 4 was always kind of ugly. I think some people are having to come to terms with that fact, but it doesn't look amazing. I don't like Bethesda's creaky engine always introduces new and strange, horrifying problems on every platform. It'll be there if you really want portable Fallout 4 Anniversary Edition. That's your option. The other one that looks that I can't imagine this will run well is Elder Scrolls 4 Oblivion Remastered. That game runs like shit on everything. I'm very curious what this will look like.
Yep.
In between those, we got Indiana Jones and the Great Circle, which looks like a fucking dynamite port and inexplicably, somehow, is going to be on cart.
I don't understand.
And I need to be clear how insane that is, because if you don't remember, when it came out on PS5 and Xbox Series X, the disc was basically empty. Mm-hmm. It was just enough data to tell it to download the game.
Yep.
Yeah.
The one system that has an actual like designation that like this is what that is and what that does is the one that gets it on the on the physical media.
What's even crazier is, you know, some people may be thinking, oh, this is probably like a case
some with... sort of misprint or error.
No, it's some case where it's like the port of Star Wars, where hey, it's actually only like 20 gigabytes on Switch 2. Nope, I looked on the eShop, it is 60 gigabytes. So that is
like that is just coming under the line
largest cart.
Yeah, like that is coming in just under the line of what you can fit.
Yeah.
But yeah, like that will be nice to have on cart so they don't have to give it 60 yes. gigs of space. But yeah, no, that's deranged. And then like for a minute I thought maybe they had misprinted what it like, and it was just like the fact sheet had gone out with some sort of like labeling error and that it was secretly a key card. But then like people started looking at the fact sheet and it's like, oh yes, you may have to download data if you wish to play with the Polish dub.
Yeah, that is like
the Polish dub.
Yes, this is like the most random shit I've ever seen.
I wouldn't. I want that though.
It'll sound less distracting that Indy isn't Harrison Ford. But yeah, just a very, very strange. But you know, I've a lot of Machine Games who previously did the Wolfenstein games, a lot of their games on variants of the id Tech engines have shown themselves to be remarkably good at conforming to platforms with more limited power. So you know, I'm happy to see them continue this tradition. And hoping that the port looks as good as that trailer was, because the trailer was quite good.
Yeah.
I think that's out in May?
Yep.
So, yeah. First person Nazi punching ahoy.
Gotta punch Nazis.
Yep. Okay, so Four Fire Miner has had to sit through all of that recap. I'm going to hit a couple of these questions real quick.
And then we have to do the Metroidvania minute after we do a few of his questions.
Okay. Fireminer says, right way back at the start, I know that there's a growing anti-remake sentiment as a backlash to perceived quote-unquote lazy and uninspired remakes such as Silent Hill 2, MGS 3, and Persona 3. I think I'm at least 30% of that, but...
Right, that's you. That's all you.
It's just me. It's a good thing more people are aware about examining video games as art that exists in specific contexts as well as what makes the essences of these games. However, many of these people also reject FF7 Remake and consider it a meta remake not worth engaging. The reasoning seems to be that if you want to comment on a game, just write an essay or make your own fanfic sequel that tries to quote-unquote replace the original. First question, looking at how Square Enix advertises FF7 Remake, do you get any sense that they want the remake to fully displace the original and should be the one that new fans play first? So, for which one you play first, I don't think they super care. But for the question of, although, like, obviously, if you get Hamaguchi to comment, he is going to say, oh, we should play the new one because, that, you know, you'll have an easier time getting started with that. And there's some wisdom to that. But they've very specifically not tried to bury the original in the sense right. that it's still available on everything. And if you pre-ordered FF7 Remake on Switch 2, they just gave it to you. They want you to play it. Like, I think that is the clearest indication that they still consider the original game to be valid on its own outside of the remake itself. Like, FF7 Remake is, as all remakes are, a sequel. It's just more in conversation with the original than most. It's more willing to literalize the fact that it is. And when I say it's a sequel, I mean, like, that it can never, like, a remake by its nature, like, you know, I won't do this too much because I do all this shit constantly, but a remake can never exist in a world where the original is not there. And that so
it must be considered in context of what it was before.
Yes. And so, like, 7 Remake is just much more literal about that than most. But I do respect the fact that, like, they just straight up with 7 Remake when they re-released it on Switch 2 and Xbox, it's just like, here, pre-order it, you get the original. You can experience that original version. They've never taken it out of circulation. They've specifically gone out of their way to make sure it stays in circulation.
They, in fact, recently put it out on an actual cart for your Switch.
Put it out on an actual cart. They are re-releasing
it in your hands.
They're re-releasing it on PC.
Yep.
Like, very, very, like, for good and ill, they've always been careful to make sure that FF7 is not, like, something where they've never treated FF7's original release like something that they are ashamed of or think that the new one ameliorates the need to exist or play. And I very much appreciate that because it's an important aspect of, like, it makes the argument for what 7 Remake's doing much, like, much stronger because it's saying, because it is tacitly saying, even in a PR sense, the original is still there. It still exists and it still should be available to be played. And which allows the remake to be more directly in conversation with the legacy of that game and what the expectations are for it as a remake. Okay, I'm cutting myself off there because otherwise I will do this same shit that I do every time for another 2 hours. Second question. Am I hallucinating to think that Advent Children and Dirge of Cerberus, to a lesser extent, already contain some meta-commentaries? What kind of meta-commentary is tolerated or accepted to a fandom like FF7? It needs to, like, there is meta-commentary within them. It needs to be understood that very few people took those stories terribly seriously. In a way that, like...
Yeah.
In the way that they do. Like, with the remake, they were like, well, this is the remake, and so they looked at it in a much more, critical light than they did Advent Children, which was like, this is a dumb action movie, or Dirge of Cerberus, which was mostly looked at as, why the hell is Square making a shooting game? and, like, they didn't make a good shooting game, but there are elements to be considered in that game's very strange narrative. But yeah, I think that it really comes down to that, like, even the most ardent FF7 fan did not take those games terribly seriously. And so it was considered much less, they were much less concerned with finding, noticing, or interacting with the meta commentary. Okay, third question. Since these are all FF7 related, I'm going to hit these before you do your Metroidvania minute.
Okay.
Third question. Okay. Could all of these negative reactions be solved had FF7 Remake simply been named FF7 Reimagined? No! People are still mad about changes being made to DQ7. like, the word remake is loaded, but bearing in mind that, like, you can say it as many different ways as you want, a certain amount of people are going to say, well, you just need to make the same game again, because that's all I want. And then if you do
same
that...
Same game's still available.
Yeah. And if you do that, you get nerds like me who are saying, this isn't what I want. This is just the same thing again. I could already play this. And if you don't do that, you get nerds like them that are like, but I just wanted the same game again. And so, like, there's no way to make both of us happy. I just want more developers to make me happy. Okay. But yeah, like, Reimagined, like, you can do the semantic dance about about what word you use. But I will put it as as one of the developers on Silent Hill Shattered Memories put it, where when that game came out, they were very insistent, this is not a remake of Silent Hill, this is a reimagining. And fans did not understand or care. No amount of telling them it's a reimagining stopped them from saying, why is this so different? It's just Silent Hill 1. Why isn't it like Silent Hill 1? And it's like, we said it was a reimagining. We said it was not a remake. And it didn't matter. It does not matter. Like,
yeah.
People will make up their minds about what they think something is and get mad when it's not.
Yeah, my only gripe is just when you have something labeled as a remake and it's just a remaster. It doesn't change anything.
Mm.
You know? That's all.
Yeah.
That's the me kind of person.
Yeah. Make sure that you know where this thing falls on the spectrum of remake to remaster.
Yeah. I would say make whatever you want, just label it appropriately, market it appropriately. That's all. You know?
But yeah. A remake should be different. You are making something again from the ground up. You need to make choices that reflect the changes that are being made. Even if you're just trying to update the art style is going to have had implications on how the game was designed around it, and you need to make updates accordingly. But that's another thing. Let's take a break from me ranting for the Metroidvania minute.
Okay, so this is a new segment I'm going to be doing for a while, probably, because obviously, thanks to Metroid Prime 4 and Hollow Knight shenanigans with my son, I've been on a Metroidvania kick, so I'm just going to take a brief minute to talk about whatever Metroidvania I'm playing at the moment.
When you finish this explanation of what the segment is, I'm putting 60 seconds on the clock. Okay.
All right, you got it. So I've been playing a game called Agalos, which is by a developer called Wonder Boy Bobby. So it's a game that's very much like the old Wonder Boy games, which I've not played, but it apparently plays very much like them. Yes, it's technically a Metroidvania, but think more like a classic action RPG, just in a side-scrolling platform fashion.
Which is very much what the Wonder Boy games after the first one were like.
Yes, and that's what it is. It's plays, looks, and sounds very retro, but has some modern touches, and is, I think it's still on sale on Switch for like $3 right now. Highly recommend. Very simple and easy to get into, and very hard to get lost because there's a person that you can just go to and they'll kind of tell you where to go. Very fun game. Highly recommend. And probably going to do Ender Lilies next because I bounced off of
Time.
Give me a few extra seconds to remember the name. Okay. Nine Souls. Nine Souls. Bounced off Nine Souls.
Gotcha.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's going to be many a minute. Get used to those.
Farmer says, I beat Agalos when it debuted. It was a good game. Good find, Wheel. Thank you.
Yeah. It's good when you look back through there's there's an there are like tons of indie titles for these kinds of old school 2D games.
Yes.
And plenty to be found. So.
Yes. It actually popped up constantly on Amazon and I always ignored it. Like snubbing my finger at snubbing my nose at this weird looking retro game, and I finally bought it and loved it. So yeah. Highly recommend. And a sequel is coming out this year, which looks even better. So there you go. All right.
Yeah, and Ender Lilies already has a sequel as well.
Yes, and I've heard Magnolia. It's wonderful. So you'll probably hear a report on that next. and by the way, just a note, I'm not saying Nine Souls is bad. I will go back to it and check it out. It just did not click with me, and I don't have the patience to try and force anything else right now.
Yeah, that one plays more like a 2D Sekiro, you know. So it's tricky.
It's probably not for me, but we'll see.
And then now I think last week I think I already mentioned The Last Faith, which plays very much like a 2D Bloodborne, which was kind of neat. So I would recommend checking that out if you like Bloodborne and Blasphemous. So
it's on my list.
And, you call it Blasphemous.
I'm currently playing God of War Ragnarok finally, and that has some Metroidvania elements to it as well. Like you can revisit early areas and you got to find these apple things to upgrade your maximum health and stuff. So that's my contribution to the Metroid Minute, which probably no, two minutes.
The Metroid 3 minutes. So that's
fine. Boo, get your own segment.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry.
Okay. You can call your segment Joe Troidvania.
Don't know what that means.
I hate it.
No.
I hate it.
Go back. Okay.
I'm the worst person.
Quick one. More quick ones that are related to the questions that were had before. Fourth question. Like I've asked before on the show, there are many people who think that any good piece of art that is not a sequel should be self-contained and doesn't require you to read other works for context. There are also people who hate how games, movies, etc. can't just be singularly themselves and are forced to span sequels, DLCs, etc. And I would say that, like, even if other works don't exist as direct context, oftentimes things will have assumed cultural context, and so there is no such thing as a truly contextless work. It's just a question of when it's left its original context, is it still of worth to the audience? But that wasn't the question. Let's move on. When these criticisms are directed towards FF7 Remake, how much of it comes down to new fans realizing that they have to play the original for context? Honestly, I think that's probably the smallest portion. I think that new players will see things and get confused, but I think that playing the old game, like, it'll explain things, but mostly the context stands largely on its own if you have broad strokes knowledge that FF7 exists and what a Sephiroth is. Otherwise, a lot of the new stuff is new and confusing to old players who had strong opinions about what the game was. How much down to old fans being displeased with how FF7 Remake recontextualizes the original? I would say that's probably a lot of it. How much down to people that think that Rebirth was cowardly for doing many things, retreading many things from the original instead of deviating even further from FF7 Remake? I think that's probably a pretty small class. You have to be, you have to have pretty specific thoughts on it. I think that 7 Rebirth is interesting because it's thematically about its own closeness to the original in a lot of ways. There's a lot of stuff about, like, false choices and narratives being compressed down to fewer possibilities just as time goes by. So I think that the game is definitely in part about its own closeness to the original and expectations of greater differences. And also I think that at some point you kind of have to allow that the third part is going to be the make or break point about the point that they're making. And so that's going to be the real question of where 7 Remake, Rebirth, and whatever the third one ends up being come together. Let's see. And how much down to people not wanting to spend hundreds of dollars and hundreds of hours for a complete experience of the trilogy? Well, you're not going to be able to do anything about the hours, but I will say that they've been remarkably aggressive in pricing the 7 remakes.
Yeah.
You can just purchase one. And, like, if you pre-order 2, they gave you the first one. And, like, routinely, the 2-pack of both of them goes down to relatively quite cheap. Even, like, the new re-releases, which I'm very used to Square Enix being like, we can just charge whatever, $70, have been $40 and $50, respectively. So, like, I think that if you're really concerned about the money, you will be able to get an ungodly amount of RPG all packaged together by probably 2028 for, like, $90 tops. It honestly reminds me of, like, how Kingdom Hearts is, like, people will talk about how convoluted that is, how much story there is to keep track of. Kingdom Hearts All-in-One Package and Interregnum Masterpiece, which are fundamentally the same thing, routinely go on sale for, like, $30. And there is so much game in those.
It really is.
So, like, if your concern is about value,
uh-huh.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm getting a message. Let me just finish this.
No worries.
Okay, but yeah, if your concern is about value, you will not have to wait much longer after the remake trilogy is out. Like, it wouldn't even surprise me if there are some pretty aggressive pre-orders that end up looking, again, similar to how, like, because, like, a lot of AAA devs have really gotten into, like, oh, the old games are ads for the new game. They're bonus fodder. Similar to how, like, Resident Evil 7, 8, 9 on Switch 2 is $90.
Yeah, that's,
like, that's a lot of game.
It's a good deal.
It is. I mean, that's a lot of game. That's 7 and 8 with all of their DLC. They have a lot of DLC.
Yeah. I mean, if you assume, like, okay, the new game, what is it by itself? $70?
Yeah. You're getting an additional 2 games for $10 each.
Yeah. That's
ridiculous. Wow.
It's ridiculous.
That's good.
Yeah. Like, because AAA developers have started to get really aggressive with, like, trying to, like, they are aware that there is a perception that AAA games are just expensive, and oh god, we have to, I'm going to briefly touch on some news that just came out. So 2XKO, the fighting game from the League of Legends developer, officially exited beta and reached full release 3 weeks ago.
Oh.
And half of its team has now been fired.
That's ridiculous.
That's Riot Games, that right?
Yeah.
What's that?
That's Riot Games. They suck.
Yeah. Riot sucks. And, like, working in video games is being treated with the indignity of, like, being a hog on the farm.
Yeah.
It sucks. I feel terrible for the people involved. But yeah, they, like, 3 weeks in, they've essentially decided that there's no way for it to potentially makes money back, and that game is simply not, that they basically already put it into, like, maintenance mode.
Jesus.
Like, they'll still be making updates, but, like, they're talking about, like, our plans are too ambitious for what makes sense. But yeah, I would not be surprised if, like, 2XKO is essentially not playable in the by this time next year.
Was it bad, or did no one give a shit?
But, like, I know of people who, you know, who are, like they hired a bunch of people that were either fighting game developers or big fighting game community members. I know a lot of people who were good, got pulled into this, and are now just out on their ass. It sucks. But it's one of those things, like, the other thing I was going to say was, like, and to tie this back, AAA developers are aware that their products are seen as very expensive. And so they're trying to create, like, if you have previous games, you can create the appearance, like, you can create the appearance of value in consumers' minds. And, you know, like, every time I look at this, like, AAA games are expensive. I'm not going to lie. But also, like, God, free-to-play is a nightmare. Like, I was looking at... I was looking this up. You could get vouchers to purchase 8 additional characters from the, like, 6 that were available... 6 or 12 that were available at launch. I can't remember which. 3 costumes and all the alternate character colors for $100.
The fuck?
Like, for 2XKO. Like, the prices on especially cosmetics in free-to-play is abusive even outside the realm of gacha.
Yeah.
And I cannot imagine, like, I just have a fundamentally different value proposition. And, like, that value proposition gets different if you don't have enough money for either, in which case, well, one of them I can play even if I don't have all the things I want, and one of them I can't play. But the second that you start putting money into the machine, the free-to-play numbers get horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just one of those things I've been thinking about in the wake of that. Yeah. Okay. So that's been taking too long. Let me move this.
Fuck Riot Games.
Yeah. Fuck Riot Games.
Yep.
Let's see. So hitting some more ones. Skyrim dumbed down Oblivion's system mechanics, which in turn dumbed down Morrowind's system mechanics. There's something to be said about a CRPG having too many, too obtuse underlying structures that make the game less fun. That said, we're talking about video games and not tabletop RPGs, where you got to get into the weeds. Yeah, I think ultimately, like, the push was to make it clearer how your choices were affecting what your character would do, and the view was likely that that all of these additional mechanics were obfuscating, like, well, what am I getting at level up? So I get why they did it. I think they probably pushed a little too far for Skyrim, but yeah. After playing modern CRPGs like Baldur's Gate 3, what do you think these games do well in hiding the complexity of their mechanics, either by having the computer doing all the calculations or making it so the results of the interactions rely on fewer and fewer variables? I think, like, Baldur's Gate 3, it's a few things. Like, the first is that, like, it's just that D&D 5e was already a very well-known, liked, and understood system. So even if you didn't play it, you probably knew someone who did if you were interested in purchasing a game like Baldur's Gate 3. And then eventually when it broke free of those containments and became like a huge, you know, tens of millions seller, that version, like, there was a lot of resources that a player who didn't understand that game could easily interact with and access. So BG3 had the advantage. Sorry, another message.
It's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree that just being able to manage some of the longer series of mathematical equations or certain interactions would help a lot.
Mm. Yeah. And you see that, like, obfuscating complex math is, you know, people had learned ways to do that even by the 2000s. Like, you know, KOTOR is running, Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic in its original form is running on a modified D&D 3.5. Like, it's just a modified 3.5 E that was, like, you know, somewhat fucked with to better suit being a video game and to better suit like the Star Wars universe. But, you know, that's kind of what you're doing.
There was, like, an official Star Wars offshoot of based on the 3.5 rules. Is it based on that or is it kind of its own thing? I can't remember.
I think it's its own thing. I've never checked.
Okay. I don't remember because I briefly we maybe played that game once with friends, so I don't even remember. But I know that was a thing.
Yeah. But yeah, so it's one of those things, like, having, like, that's the real advantage that starting with D&D rules gets you, is that you get, like, some, your core audience has more inbuilt familiarity with how they function. There's a bunch of other things that BG3 is doing. The interface generally highlighting things that you can do and having a lot of options that a lot of D&D games kind of don't do, ultimately has a lot to do with this as well. Like, you know, if I decide that, oh, maybe I will have this character jump to the next area or throw something, there is, you know, that nice little handy turn. Oh, that's another thing. Unlike a lot of, like, the, because, you know, of course there were D&D games in the 2000s. Unlike a lot of those, this game was strictly turn-based.
Mm.
That gives people a lot of time to come to grips with, like, figuring out, well, what is this going to do if I choose to do it?
Yeah, I've tried some of the earlier D&D games and some Japanese games that were based off the same sort of engine, and having this run in real time is really, really difficult.
Yeah, real time with pauses is really overwhelming.
I like real time with pause.
You would.
I get it. I'm just saying, it's especially for a new player, it's very overwhelming.
I think that Pillars of Eternity is the real Baldur's Gate 3.
Wow. You don't like Baldur's Gate 3?
I don't like it as much as 2, and I don't like it as much as
interesting
Icewind Dale, and yeah.
Mm.
Never said I didn't like it. It's more so I just don't always have the patience for it. It's more so the fact that I actually don't like just regular D&D all that much, to be honest. I don't like the randomness with the dice rolls.
I think also just one of the things they choose not to obfuscate that games typically did, and this is kind of coming to vogue with, like, very RNG heavy games, is to just show the player that you're rolling the dice. Just let them watch that play out. I think that makes it feel less random, even though it's not actually any less random. But just seeing that, like, you didn't hide the dice roll, you didn't just tell me a number, you showed me rolling the dice. I think that things like that, or like Disco Elysium, one of the things that it'll do is it will, when you're making a roll, it will show you everything that is giving, that is helping and hurting your attempt. Like, those kinds of things, I think, do a lot to make it so that players feel like they have, even though they don't actually have, even if the result is as random as before, just the feeling that you understand why this role is going to go the way that it does a lot to help players kind of acclimate.
Yeah, I did like when, like, I'm playing as a bard and I'm trying to, like, unlock something, and it tells me, okay, yeah, you're getting plus 5 points for this reason, plus 2 points for this reason, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then I would still just, I guess maybe I'm just a baby, I just get, you know, you roll a zero and you still fail, and you're like, what the fuck? You know, like, yeah. I have all this
still fail. That's pretty normal. You must be thinking of Seiko.
But that's it. I'm just, like, for instance, they're saying you need a 13 to unlock this thing. I'm like, okay. And with all of your modifiers, you're getting plus 10. Great. And then you roll a 1, and you're like, well, what the hell? I failed anyway.
That's very much a, oh, shit. Oh, well.
Yeah. No, I was a save scrummer, whatever it is.
Save scummer.
Every time I screw up a dice roll, it's like, nope, I'm trying again. I don't care. Yeah. I wasn't playing it right.
Another thing that at least the computer versions are good for, depending on the system being used, you may end up having too many items that affect things that you don't remember exist. This is an occasional problem with Pathfinder, where you may not remember what you're holding on to that may actually be pertinent at one point. So at least for inventory management, a big plus here. Very big plus. On the other hand, you can't fake not, you know, oh, I do have an extra point left. Yes, I do. That kind of thing. Nor can you bribe the game master, usually.
Usually.
I know a couple of indie games out there where you possibly did have a bribe the game master mechanic. So, and at least one where the game master was the final boss. So it was kind of fun with that one.
Yeah, and I think at one point there's some kind of interaction early on with like an animal, and my character kicked it and I actually rolled a 20. So oh, no. it went flying and smashed against the wall and exploded.
Were you playing with the Dark Urge?
Maybe. I don't know.
Like, I'm just saying that because I can't imagine why else you would kick a dog.
No, it was a squirrel or something. I don't know.
I still wouldn't just kick a small animal.
I don't know. Something happened, and for whatever reason, my character did something to an animal.
An animal so hard it exploded.
I rolled a 20 when you absolutely don't want or need to roll a 20, and some ridiculous thing happens. That's all. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Or maybe it was an aggressive animal that it attacked me. I don't know. Maybe it was a boar. I'm not sure.
Was this a video game version or an actual game session?
No, I mean Baldur's Gate 3. There's a part on where there's some animal and I don't know, I guess I kicked it and rolled a 20 and it went flying and exploded.
Weird. Okay, because the other thing I was going to mention is that for any computer game version, it's only got what it only has available what the programmers thought to put in it. So that's one of the downsides here.
BG3 is unusual.
If you were playing an actual game in this situation, the game master might just, you know, not have the small animal explode.
Yeah.
Or do something like, okay, I know that we need this thing to survive, and they don't know this yet, so you know what? It's not going to die. It's going to be pissed off, but it's not going to die. Kind of thing.
Mostly the small animals exist to give speak with animals some sort of use.
Yep.
I think I was doing a bard ranger combo on my second character, and I actually killed the owl bear, and then found out that it had a child, and then you actually get to hear the child's inner thoughts, and then I felt bad.
I had to speak with animals, like, so I negotiated with the owl bear.
Yeah, so the kid is like, Mama, what happened? And I'm like, oh no, I need to leave this cave right now.
You just can't beat this poor creature.
No.
But does anybody remember the arguments and controversy over letting owl bears actually be natural creatures in Baldur's Gate 3 instead of abominations?
I did not pay attention to this at all.
No. I remember some arguments going on because under standard Dungeons & Dragons rules, you should not be able to use to talk with animals on an owlbear because owlbears are not natural creatures.
To which I would say, it's a fucking video game, not a documentary.
Is that why people are mad the druid in the Dungeons & Dragons movie could turn into an owlbear?
Yes, actually.
Probably. Oh, God.
Yes.
That movie is excellent, by the way.
You can divide gamers between those who were so hung up on the rules that they were saying that she couldn't do it, and the rest who were going, that was really awesome. I'm going to talk my game master into letting me do that.
Yeah. As it turns out, the point of the tabletop game is for the GM and the players to come to an agreement.
Yeah. That is one thing that actual gaming has over the video game version is you can do stuff like that.
Yeah, that always hangs me up in a lot of games, especially fucking Wizardly clones sometimes that enjoy having negative levels and shit like that. Like, there's a lot of weird and annoying rules in Dungeons & Dragons, but a good DM
the kind of thing that if your DM insisted on, you'd probably be like, maybe I'm out of this loop.
But a good DM will know how to carefully apply those, or when everyone rolls negative ones and the whole party dies, perhaps not have everyone just die.
Maybe we
find a way around.
Take a turn here.
Yeah.
Okay. To hit a few more of these, will TES6 be mechanically simpler than Skyrim? I think that the general tenor and tone of where RPGs have gone over the past 5-10 years would encourage them to be more stat dense, but not a ton more stat dense. Mm. Like, that's where the trend seems like it's gone, and where I suspect Bethesda will go. Or will Bethesda look at the positive reaction to Oblivion Remaster and realize that a lot of fans, including the casual ones, are ready for something more complex? Yeah, I think that, like, the RPG market as a whole has, like, moved away from just blunt simplification, and that I think that Bethesda will be reasonably aware that there is, that the big market does not need to be mean a necessarily mechanically simpler game. Let's see. Kyoto Xanadu's gameplay elements being dispersed and unconnected is a very much late 80s, early 90s computer game developer mindset. Absolutely, absolutely. British Microcomputer Studios, OceanSoft, and Japanese MSX PC-98 Studios were always scared that the players would be bored of the games and so sandwich beat-em-ups, shmups, light guns, etc. sections between each other. It's a good call since beat-em-up slash action platformer can get old real quick. Yeah, you could get some fucking weird shit, or sometimes they would just go completely insane for different reasons. I highly recommend for those of us that can't actually play these games to go look up a YouTube channel I've talked about in the past called Basement Brothers that does a lot of videos about PC 88 and 98 games, and you run into some just really strange stuff, like wild combinations of genre that you'd never see anyone take a chance on nowadays, and games that just, like, it's a PC game, you can just put out whatever, who gives a fuck what's in it. Like, sure, we made an action RPG that's mostly set in, like, fantasy, like Babylon, where you take drugs and at the end you kill Ronald Reagan and Gorbachev. Like, a truly deranged video game.
That sounds awful.
I've heard of weirder.
You've certainly heard of weirder, but it is worthy of note
I mean, granted, that sounds like something that an Assassin's Creed game might end up doing. Just because, again, because that, I mean, that is the series where you ended up, like, fighting a pope on top of a giant buried pyramid under Rome at one point, wasn't it? Something like that?
It wasn't a buried pyramid, but yes, you did fight the Pope in a cathedral.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's one of
and
the
George Washington a different time.
Yeah. This game, XDR, has a slightly stranger claim because both Reagan and Gorbachev were in office at the time. But yeah, just a very strange video game.
I've seen manga from the 90s that directly, obviously made references to Bill Clinton.
Yeah, it was the style.
Yeah.
Let's see. Okay, so another one. Don't like the fact that NTSC, 3DS, and 2DS go for a lot of money nowadays, but it makes some sense that they have such weird form factors and can't be easily emulated on a handheld. Somehow old Wonder Swan crystals can go for as much as a normal 3DS nowadays. Swan crystal wasn't even that different from the normal Wonder Swan color, and you can modify a Swan color to have a backlit LCD screen, and probably one that doesn't ghost to hell. But yeah, there's like the issue you run into is that, like, I think a lot of the people that would want a Wonder Swan in the year of our Lord 2026 are people that want, like, a perfectly preserved original, and there's just only so many Wonder Swan crystals like that.
I do have one. It's just that the battery pack gave up the ghost like 15 years ago or more.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in a box somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I figure if I ever somehow manage to get a copy of the Atelier game for Wonder Swan Color, I will dig it out and try to find some way of fixing it, but that's never going to happen. So.
Okay. And relatedly, speaking of the WonderSwan, did you know that while the PS1 port of FF4 was based on the WonderSwan version, the PS1 port of Chrono Trigger used the SNES ROM with the translation being overlaid in real time? Yep, that's why it loads so fucking shitty. It is constantly having, like, the PS1 does not have a lot of memory to spare, and constantly having to apply a translation patch in real time is not a good use of it.
That is just insane.
I wouldn't think so.
I would love to know what the thought process was behind not just using an English version of the ROM. But,
I mean,
yeah,
maybe they didn't have an English version of the ROM available? I don't know. Maybe, I don't know how, but...
Yeah, like, this... Like, the other thing is that this solution would have required a lot of engineering. Like, that is a really weird and difficult thing to do. So, like, there has to have been a reason this was chosen. But I don't know what it was. But yeah, that is how it functioned. It's part of why it runs. It loads so shitty, even compared to some of the other PS1 ports of Super Nintendo games. It's because it's constantly playing that fucking patch in the background. Let's see. Apparently the Switch port of Fire Emblem 1 did the same thing. It did. It's running like Lua scripts in the background to hot swap in text instead of hacking the base ROM. I can kind of understand why, because that would require, you know, ROM hacking a Famicom game that definitely never had an English translation. If you're just trying to put a quick and relatively simple port out, this probably was, while still probably a huge pain in the ass, it was probably easier than digging into the source code to just find where it tries to display text and intercepting those calls. I get it why Nintendo didn't want to touch such an NES ROM, but it's strange how Square did something like that, considering Chrono Trigger was only 4 years old when the PS1 port was released. Yeah, I don't know. I couldn't tell you why they did that. I'm sure they must have had not necessarily a good reason, but a very compelling reason. Because, like, that it would have been so much work. let's see. Okay, I asked if Konami would ever put down a lot of money to make a Castlevania with the kind of production value comparable to Symphony. You answered no, and then went into the history of the Castle 32X game, blah, 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 blah. Well, but, like, will any other game studio put that much money into a Metroidvania nowadays? Is Ori 2 the ceiling for what we can expect from a 2D side-scroller? Like, honestly, from a major publisher, yeah, probably. Like, Ori and Metroid Dread are probably about as much as anyone's going to spend, and it's going to be, like, big first parties and legacy franchises. And Konami is still kind of trying to rebuild the idea that they make video games. So I don't see.
Yeah. Konami hates children too.
Damn. You heard it here first.
Well, no, that's what I learned from playing the Cowabunga collection, all of the games and beating all of them. It's like, wow, Konami hates children.
They're just really hard. I thought that was the style at the time. Especially for arcade games.
It was a style at the time. Yeah, no kidding.
Let's see. I looked at a bunch of 2D games released last year, from Neon Inferno to Hell Night Silk Song. While they're all beautiful in an elaborate way, I have this nagging feeling that we aren't going to get something as long and deep as Symphony. Yeah, it's just like, Symphony is a game that, like, I know we touched on this in the last answer, so I'll keep it short, but it's a game that congealed over the course of 3 years of development, where a lot of stuff just sort of got made. So you end up with things like the Portrait of Sire and the Neutron Bomb, and, like, just all sorts of silly things that probably wouldn't have made it into a game with a more concerted and focused development time. So it's a beautiful thing that we got to see it once, and we should appreciate it for that. But I don't think we're going to get another game like it.
What are we talking about?
Plus, we'll get our things like Bloodstained, but that's not going to be in beautiful dot art 2D.
Oh, you're talking about Symphony of the Night.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and when is that next Bloodstained game coming out? Next year?
Bloodstained 2. I don't know if it had a release date when they announced it. The Bloodstained 2, not Curse of the Moon 2. Okay, Bloodstained Scarlet Engagement is... Yeah, it's just set for 2026 at this point.
Okay.
So hopefully sometime this year, hopefully a Switch 2 version ends up happening, but I suspect that will be later. Okay. Speaking of the Wonder Swan, you know the whole Gunpei Yokoi thing of lateral thinking of withered technology kind of went out the window when you consider how advanced the N64 was. Even the NES and Super Nintendo were more advanced than most of their contemporaries and used bespoke technologies. Don't get me started on the Virtual Boy. If anything, the Genesis and Dreamcast were closer to his vision. I mean, the Dreamcast was a pretty high-end thing. The Game Boy is really the only thing I would describe as lateral thinking of withered technology that existed at Nintendo at the time. It's more something that became their ethos in the later 2000s. It's one of those things that's just... You could see some of it in their pre-console stuff, like some of the ways that things like the actual, like the Game & Watch work have elements of this as well. The N64 was infamously a hardware design that was shopped around to several hardware manufacturers before ultimately Nintendo picked it up. And it just in general, there was a lot of... It was a really hard thing to do, especially at the time, because technology was advancing so rapidly that if you tried it, you were going to produce something that was just old, like really, that felt really old. It's just that we've reached a point where, like, the difference of what technology can do has shrunk, like, you know. Enough that you can kind of get over time you've been able to get away with that more just because there's more things. Like, the older technology doesn't look Stone Age anymore. Like, you know, we're finally starting to see the PS4 go away, but like, games that come out on PS4 don't look like Stone Age games. The PS4 came out like 13 years ago. That would be the equivalent of fucking playing a Genesis game versus an Xbox game. Mm-hmm. Like, it really, you know, this idea is much easier to do when there are, man, you're getting your ass beat by these sea creatures. Mm-hmm. These ideas became much more palatable when technology no longer was, constantly increasing by leaps and bounds. And you know, that's the world we live in now. Let's see. I guess that was why Gunpei Yokoi was in the handheld division, not the home console division. Yeah, that's the other thing, is that like, the Game Boy is like, okay, we're taking an old Z80 processor and we're producing something that on its face is kind of meant to resemble the NES, and we would continue to see that, like, in the handheld division, where like the Game Boy Advance, it's not literally using the same tech as a Super Nintendo, but it's designed to use its design intention was produce something handheld with good battery life that can play games that resemble Super Nintendo games.
Yeah.
It had to do that essentially entirely in software, because it was like, because of its design, that meant that it could do a lot of things that the Super Nintendo simply couldn't, in terms of like full screen effects. You'll see a lot of weird things on the Super Nintendo that would have been on the GBA that would have been essentially impossible on the Super Nintendo, just because you can get away with a lot more when you're when the way that they were reaching that benchmark was software rather than bespoke hardware. God, these fish are just kicking your ass. But you know, even the DS, like, in terms of what its 3D can accomplish, it looks like the N64. It's not using N64 technology, but it is thinking about how we can achieve a comparable experience with a
with this new technology. And that's sort of how they ended up carrying that ethos for a very long time. Let's see. How much worth does the word remake usually have in drawing in new people who had never played the original for one reason or another? I've already talked about the cases of FF7, Yakuza, Metal Gear Solid, Persona, RE, and Silent Hill, so please find other examples to talk about. Fair enough. As a general rule, what I would say is that remake, to draw in new users, relies on the reputation of the old game.
Yeah.
Because people see it as, a lot of new users will see it as a way to catch up. Like, I never played this old thing, it's old now, I don't necessarily care about old games, but people say it's really good, and here's a remake of it. So, as just a general rule, that's the draw for new users. I've heard incredible things about this. I don't necessarily want to play an old game. So that's how I'll get through it. But you know, you look at something like the Dragon Quest remakes are very much like they're reliant on the storied nature of Dragon Quest as a franchise. That Dragon Quest is beloved, and especially in Japan, everyone knows someone who's played it, who grew up with it. You know, there's a reason that the first in the current crop of remakes was 3. Like,
oh yeah,
because that is the one that is like you,
the one that required a special law passed to keep it up to like have it go on sale on Saturday to prevent traffic.
But essentially, like, you're looking at the game that no matter what you have heard, if you live in Japan, you've heard of someone who loved it, who grew up with it, you've talked to some, you like, it exists in the cultural zeitgeist, and so you might want to play it, but you know, if you looked at the other versions, it's like that looks old and unapproachable. So, you know, you have this remake that exists as a way to help you to be able to experience it, even though you might not be able to stomach it as just like a as a, if you were to approach it as a new player. Similarly, like, you know, Dragon Quest VII Reimagined, for as much as like I might talk shit about it, because Dragon Quest was still like at the height of its power in terms of its brand recognition, and because the PS1 was at the height of its power in terms of like how many people had purchased one, like that's one of, if not the best selling Dragon Quests. In terms of just an individual release. And so, like, but, you know, built around its accreted reputation of, well, this one is, you know, a lot of people played it, a lot of people loved it, it's really infamous for being long. And so the remake ends up existing to address that concern while allowing new players to play it. It is that, I would almost describe a lot of these remakes as, because of their goal of increasing approachability, they almost function like how a lot of people might not have time or like enough concerted interest to read a book. But they might read an audiobook, or they might listen to an audiobook. And like, that's not a perfect metaphor, but it's that way that like, that they exist to make something that people want to have experienced feel more approachable. Like, to the new player, that's the value proposition. And that's why companies will go for the most beloved and most remembered. It's why that keeps happening, because they're reliant on the fact that like the X game has an incredible reputation, which makes it very easy to sell both returning and new players on it. Okay, well, we'll put Dragon Quest on the list of other ones that I'm not allowed to reference when we come to this question from another direction.
I've been holding in Counterpoint, Metal Max Xeno Reborn.
That was
the game, the remake that made me nostalgic for the not very good original.
Wow!
And a bad remake will do that.
Yeah, a bad remake of a not very good game. Yes. It came out 2 years after the original.
Yep, that's like in the process, like in that gray area between remake, updated, re-release, remaster. The answer is,
but I mean,
whatever you did to it, you fucked it up.
I mean, this one was a remake. They definitely put in a new game engine. They changed some very fundamental items to it.
Hmm.
Most of it was not fixing anything that was actually broken.
Whoops. And it did, and so it badly broken. They canceled its sequel.
It's like, but it was also one that attempted to replace the original, as in this was supposed
to be. Yeah, like it was an attempt to apologize for the original because the original was bad.
But then they made the remake worse.
Yep, incredible.
Yes.
Yeah, where is the, like, we're supposed to get a new actual Metal Max again at some point. Yeah, because Cygames bought the rights for it.
Yep, so I'm just waiting to hear about that one.
Yep.
Because it will, I mean, the fact that they were willing to put out money for it to begin with means that somebody in the company is interested in championing it, so we'll see what happens there.
Yep. We shall see. Okay. The Game Boy Color is literally a Famicom with some better features, like less flickering / better horizontal blanking. Yeah, basically. It's a shame that not more PS2 games got ported to the Wii. I'd love to have PS2 games that normally run at 480i or less running at a crisp 480p. Instead, the only things we got were some fighting games like Budokai Tenkaichi 3 and MK Armageddon, and that weird new Rygar port. God, that thing's... There's so many other ones, but they're all terrible and no one remembers them, because like a lot of companies would like just take something that had been... like had kind of succeeded at some point in their catalog and just throw it out. My personal favorite that I bring up a lot in terms of why the fuck is this here is Pitfall: The Lost Expedition, a 2004 game that like was fine and then was immediately forgotten about, and then for some ungodly reason was ported to the Wii 4 years later as and given the worst title of Pitfall: The Big Adventure. I don't know why. But yeah, there's just a handful of those. Like, there's some other weird ones, like when NIS America brought over Sakura Taisen 5 and ported it to the Wii, in the process. But yeah, there's a few of these. But like, you know, very quickly it becomes clear that, like, the market for people wanting to buy slightly cleaner-looking PS2 games was too small for a lot of these publishers to want to deal with, so we never saw it. Like, because especially, like, at the time, what ended up being in vogue was... PS2 game HD remake or HD remaster. Constant ports, especially of like Sony's first party games on PS3, but also just like other stuff would, you know, if a company was looking to devote that kind of resource to an older game, like frequently the thought process was, well, it'll sell more if we like really go at it and completely and do a more comprehensive remaster for the PS3 and 360. And that's how you get your MGS and Silent Hill and Zone of the Enders HD collections and FF10 and 10.2 HD. All these collections end up happening for that reason, that it just, as far as they're concerned, it's like, well, we might as well just do a more comprehensive up-res for the HD consoles.
Let's see. Nintendo was at least good when it came to making sure the Game & Watch games being playable on the Game Boy Color and NES/SNES games be playable on the GBA. D3 is still releasing Simple Series games for the Switch. Has Gaijin ever seen those games in store shelves?
Simple Series?
Yeah.
Switch?
Yeah, there's Switch and Switch 2 Simple games.
Not personally, but then again, I don't go to a lot of direct sale stores anymore. I could look around and report on this for next week if you'd like.
Yeah, I'd be interested to hear like how much presence they actually have at this stage.
Yeah. I mean, I would have assumed that if the Simple Series was going on, that they would have just gone strictly to download.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they've been released, but yeah, there are currently on Switch 2, there's Simple, the Mahjong, and Pool Room Billiard. Yeah, it looks like they announced a return of the Simple brand in 2022 for the Switch.
Well, I was completely unaware of this, so that should tell you exactly how obvious it is.
How much retail presence these seem to have.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll have to keep track of that. My sinuses are starting to dry up from talking too much, so now might be a good time to start.
Start wrapping.
Yeah.
So Gaijin, for less than the cost of a Simple 2000 game, where can I purchase books?
Well, if you just go to Amazon.com, for lack of any better alternatives still, dear Lord, and look up the name Michael Yarimizu, M-A-I-K-E-L-Y-A-R-I-M-I-Z-U, you will find plenty of books. Principal among them being Princesses of the Pizza Parlor, a tabletop role-playing game, live play experience in a textual format, narrative format. In which I have had to deal with the management of how best to present dice rolls or not present dice rolls. Rest assured that any time you actually see numbers come up in narrative, it actually got rolled. That was, and I had to deal with whatever happened after that. Yes, occasionally I did regret giving one character a Rod of Wonder.
That's actually the way fun. I think that's every DM ever.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was smart enough to never even consider a deck of many things involved here.
No.
You'd have just ended up with a total party kill at that point.
No, that's what you bring out when you want to destroy a setting. So. I mean, seriously. But yeah, so Princesses of the Pizza Parlor, I have finished manuscript on episode 14. I still need to type it up so I can figure out how long it is and what I need to tweak on it and get a cover done. But yeah, it's ongoing. I hope to finish out the main plot line soon. So, at which point there will be 15 episodes, 5 side stories, and a paralogue novel. And I'm not sure how close it'll be, but it'll be almost as long as War and Peace altogether. Within a few thousand, I think. Need to check that again. To go with the old joke. And then, different sort of gaming experience. We have a lit RPG, Vainglorious Long as the Night. Same author, same location. Just, it's like, in a genre that seems to be dominated by very specific modes of role-playing game to emulate. I was just like, yeah, I'm going to do a Metroidvania. So the majority of lit RPG tends to be either World of Warcraft style, D&D style, or I was going to Sword Art Online, or World of Warcraft, whatever. And I was like, no. We're going to be parodying Symphony of the Night while also making fun of every single B-movie I can think of.
It's as Castlevania would have wanted it.
Yes. I mean, you can't take yourself too seriously on this while also having a fairly threatening vampire major boss. So, a lot of fun. apparently a little light on the stats department for some people. I don't care. It has stats. I make use of the stats. I refer to the stats. I've got a little stat box that pops up regularly. I just don't feel the need to have 50 different minor stats and a 5-page list of inventory every chapter. Yeah. Some issues with some of the genre in this case. And then beyond that, we have Tanuki is a Teapot, a Japanese folk tales. Zero relevance to video games, but very cute. Folk tales about animals in Japan. Some of them known, some of them not known, some of them first time ever in English. All good. More to come. Working on that. About halfway through that one. And then from the other pen name under Michael Spearwater, we have a mid-fantasy world travelogue romantasy that is a lot of things that I would not be putting under the same name as someone who has written a bunch of YA of young adult fantasy shorts. So let the reader beware on this one, but I had a lot of fun writing that one too. Hopefully soon to have a couple other books under that pen name as well. More for language, because at least one of these has zombies in it, and you really cannot have a good zombie story without some cussing. A lot of cussing.
Yeah. It's just a little bit how it's built.
Yeah. So, yeah, keeping the less explicit language under one pen name and the more explicit language on the other pen name. So, having fun here. Okay, anyway, I will keep you guys informed of how that goes.
Gotcha. Important. Stay tuned for the next thrilling episode. Let's see. Joe, where can we find you?
You can find me on the RP Gamer Twitch channel, which you might be watching right now, on Tuesday and Thursday nights, starting around 9 or 10 p.m. Eastern time. And that's really all I've been doing. I've just been streaming for RP Gamer, and on my last stream was Rune Factory Guardians of Ozima, and I got to a point where there was this like boss gauntlet, so I think I'm getting close to the end of the game. And I had stopped playing Pokemon Legends EA because I got to the end of the DLC and didn't have the right berries to make the donuts to get the other legendaries, and I thought, that's fine, I'll just do that in my own time. So I'm going to be doing Rune Factory Gardens of Ozima until I finish it or until I get East 10 Proud Nordics, but it looks like I'm going to be finishing it very soon, possibly this week. So either I'll do something else for the other two streams next week or just take a week off. I don't know. We'll see. And I'm supposed to get East 10 Proud Nordics for PS5 in the mail at some point, and then that's going to be my next streaming game for them. You can find me on twitch.tv/smokinjoegamer and also on YouTube under smokinjoegamer. And you can follow me on Blue Sky, Joey at smokinjoegamer.bsky.social. So, there's different platforms you can follow me on. And I've got a whole bunch of YouTube videos that you can watch, mostly gaming related, some are music related, like album reviews and stuff. And I haven't done a new video in a while, but you can watch my Holiday Buying Guide 2025, where I play a bunch of games from 2025, tell you if they're any good or not, and help you decide if you want to buy them. So those are still relevant, you know, if you haven't bought any of those games, or if, you know, you're curious about Mario Kart World, Donkey Kong Bonanza, you know, just think some of the big games from 2025 are all on there. That's really all I got for you. I'm always coming up with ideas for content, but it's a matter of actually sitting down and doing it. So it does take some effort. Stay tuned for that. But, you know, maybe I'll, record a new song at some point. Maybe I'll do another album review. Maybe I'll find some other video game themed content. It doesn't look like I'm going to be doing Final Fantasy February again. Wasn't planning on it, but might do
Mario March or something like that, and I'll still do Metroidvania, I'm sure, when May comes around, and I'll do JRPG July. But yeah, no, really nothing in the pipeline right now, but I've got hundreds of old videos you can watch anytime you want on YouTube. So please consider liking, subscribing, following, whatever the contextual thing is on any given platform.
Good. As for us, you can catch us when we stream at usually between 8 and 9 p.m. Pacific, 11 to midnight Eastern on Mondays. I am not going to be here next Monday. I'm having the day off.
So then we will return in 2 weeks.
Yep. I thought I'd mentioned that. Sorry.
I think you did, and we probably all forgot.
You got big plans for President's Day?
I've got people that'll be in town over the weekend.
That's cool. All right. I'm like, what holiday is it? It's like President's Day. Oh, hey.
It's an excuse for a 3-day weekend. I don't need more than that.
Yeah, you know what? You're right. You're right.
But So
we'll be back the 23rd then. Okay.
Yeah. You'll be able to tell us how ETH is.
Yeah, hopefully I'll get it, because that comes out, what, the 20th? Yeah.
The 20th.
So yeah, hopefully I'll...
Forgetting that's going to happen. I got to put money aside for that. But, yeah, so ETH... not ETH. But yeah, so normally, yeah, between 8 and 9 p.m. Pacific, 11 to 12 p.m., 11 p.m. to 12 a.m. Eastern on Mondays, barring President's Day, we will be here. We also have Shenanigans, our sister show. That's usually at 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern on Sundays. Yesterday, while I finished Clair Obscur, which I will have like a final thoughts on next time we convene, Wheels and Joe did, what were you doing a run in? Marvel Cosmic Invasion.
Yeah.
That was fun.
Yeah, we beat it last night. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I didn't get a chance to talk about everything I've been playing. I'm not going to go into it, but I'm just going to say I've rolled credits on 5 games already over the past month. So
wow.
Just really good pacing. And yeah, just last night we finished Marvel Cosmic Invasion, and It was pretty cool. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
You can also ask us questions via... so if you want to ask us questions, if you catch us while we're streaming, that's usually good. That'll be at twitch.tv/askwheels for Shenanigans, and both askwheels and twitch.tv/rpgamer for our actual recorded episodes. Q&A quest itself. You can also ask us questions in the comments section on RP Gamer under this episode, or in the RP Gamer Discord, which you can get to by going to the community tab of RP Gamer and clicking on the invite link. It's a lovely community, whether you want to ask us questions or not, but we always appreciate it when we see them in the podcast section. Otherwise, I think that about wraps it up for us. So I guess I'll say, see you, Space Cowboys.
See you.
See you.
This is Mole Man in the morning. Good Mole Man to you.